listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's fall membership drive is just around the corner. Help us kick off our KBOO Out Loud Drive on August 20th for National Radio Day, where we'll bring you more of our independently made content, KBOO stories, and KBOO testimonials all day long.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning and welcome to the KBOO Radio Bike Show. Nedra, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're coming loud and clear, as they say. Welcome to the show and take it from here.
Yes, we are broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon, and Alon is at the studio. We are on 90.7 FM, streaming on HTTPS. KBOO.FM. All shows are archived on the bike show, portland.portlandtransport.com. I am co-host Nedra Deadweiler, and Alon Robb will join us briefly. Our show engineer for today is Nate Vandiver. Just want to say a big thank you to our listeners. We appreciate you joining us every time we're on the show. We just want to just say, please give us, donate, you know, share as much as you can. Funding for Corporation for Public Broadcasting also affects KBOO, and we welcome all and any contributions. We're also honored to be carried by fellow community stations across the land. We're on every other Sunday at noon on KORC Corvallis, streaming worldwide at korcfm.com, and we have a new partner, Radio Tacoma. For today's show, Alon will be sharing the news and also interviewing a Scottish chef and cyclist, Alan Murchison, who recently purchased the cookbook, The Cycling Chef, Plant-Powered Performance, Vegan Recipes to Fuel Your Ride. And in the second half of the show, I will interview Pacha Gavalis. She is the founder of BC Chica. So, Alon, will you join us again?
Yes, and I hope you're doing well, Nedra, as well as could be in these crazy times. These are two news items from the vast bicycle universe that made me smile. In an article titled A Massive Win as Court Rules in Favor of Cyclists in Landmark Bike Lane Case, Momentum magazine reports that the Ontario Superior Court has ruled that the provincial government over there, their actions to remove bike lanes in Toronto violated Canadians' charter rights, and that decisions, the decisions they wanted to make, increasing risk to the public. especially cyclists and pedestrians, are unconstitutional. So won't it be great if the Constitution was observed in this country too? But the court decided, it recognized that cyclists have rights, they have to be protected, they have to be safe, and that's a huge win for cyclists in Toronto and everywhere. And hopefully it will carry on to many other places. And another good news item. So, you know, anybody who's been on a bicycle knows that it provides so many joys. But sadly and maddeningly, too many cyclists and pedestrians are hit by cars. Even one is too many. And in the last week alone, two pedestrians were killed in Portland. These deaths, though, are not inevitable. Helsinki, Finland's capital city, with a population of 1,350,000 residents, has had no deaths on its road since July 2024. So 1 year, no traffic deaths. By contrast, my city of Portland, Oregon, with a population of 615,000, less than half of Helsinki's, had 58 traffic fatalities in 2024, of which 22 were pedestrians and 3 cyclists. Ronnie Otrenian, a traffic engineer with the city of Helsinki, attributed this achievement to many factors, with speed limits one of the most important. More than half of all the streets in Helsinki have a speed limit of 30 kilometers, and that includes all streets by schools. In addition, pedestrian and cycling infrastructure has significantly been upgraded, crosswords were made safer, and more traffic cameras have been installed. So it also helps, of course, that their public transportation system is excellent, which reduces car use. So may the example of Helsinki in eliminating traffic deaths on its streets carry on. So, first guest today, I'll say goodbye to you, Nedra, for now, and continue with our first guest today. Our first guest today has been described by Cycling Magazine as the world fastest Michelin-starred chef. Scottish Alan Murchison is a man as comfortable preparing an award-winning meal at a restaurant as he is racing a bicycle. Chef, restaurant owner, runner, cyclist, he's the author of several cookbooks published by Bloomsbury, including the recent The Cycling Chef, Plant-Powered Performance, Vegan Recipes to Fuel Your Ride. He has prepared nutritious and yummy meals for elite athletes and teams, as well as for the recreational rider runner, and is also a world and European sprint duathlon champion in his age group. We are happy to have Mr. Murchison on the phone speaking to us from Spain. Are you on?
I'm good. I'm here, Alan. Good to speak to you.
Welcome to the show. And before I ask you those tough questions I prepared, I want to confess that under gentle pressure from Rachel, my beloved, I prepared 2 dishes, the curried cauliflower, chickpea, and kale salad, and also the greens is for go, and they were nutritious, yummy, and according to Rachel, had a wonderful texture that complements the flavors in surprising ways. So thank you for that also. You mentioned in the book that cycling and cooking are the 2 passions of your life, and both are steeped in culture and tradition. How did you come to these loves?
I was brought up cycling to and from school, so I was always on a bike, from racing BMX when I was really young. And I started working in the kitchen when I was 14 years old, but both my grandmothers were very good cooks, and I always have fond memories of growing up just around the kitchen table. And I also then, when I started working in kitchens, I enjoyed the teamwork and the environment within a professional kitchen. So the parallels are fairly similar that, you know, within cycling, professional sport, there's a lot of teamwork, a lot of passion, and it's the same in kitchens. So the two kind of cross over quite nicely.
And you note in the book, you say that cyclists and chefs are always standing or pedaling on the shoulders of giants. Who are some of those giants for you?
Oh, this is a good question. Well, cycling's a constantly evolving sport. You know, I was a big Indurain fan. I remember watching Miguel Indurain win his 5 tours. Mm-hmm. And I actually was out in the Alps watching Miguel Indurain when he won his 5th Tour de France. I remember watching this. But more increasingly, I'm inspired by the growth in women's cycling. That's something I find really inspirational. And I really enjoyed watching the Women's Tour de France that's just finished. So I would say that I'm inspired by people that push boundaries. Mm-hmm. So I would say that the women's sport at the moment, I'm finding really exciting. It's very dynamic. And I was very inspired by watching the Women's Tour de France. From a cooking perspective, I worked for a number of years for a French chef called Raymond Blanc. Now, Raymond Blanc has trained more Michelin-starred chefs than anybody else that I'm aware of. So I worked for him for nearly 5 years. So I would say that Raymond Blanc was my inspiration as I was a developing chef. But now, it's very different now. I much prefer sort of home cooking and simple cooking these days. So it's always changing.
Hmm. And Ed Clancy, winner of 3 Olympic gold medals in cycling, wrote that you take the nonsense out of cycling, food, and nutrition. What have been some major misconceptions or nonsense about food and cycling?
I think people generally overcomplicate it. And I think the problem is you've got to look at food as that food is a passion. You know, food is something that brings people together. And I think you can suck the joy out of food if you overcomplicate it. And what I've tried to do with all the recipes is I've tried to make sure they're simple, they're nutritious, and they're repeatable. So you can buy everything in a local store and you can cook it in under 30 minutes. So this is always my aim with the food, is to take out all the nonsense and just concentrate on the key things that are important.
Hmm. And the book has lovely photos of past cyclists, often on their bikes or cycling during a race, and somebody's handing them some food. You mentioned in the past, you know, a lot of times cyclists ate what Italians ate, a lot of pasta. The French were big on bread. Were, as far as you know, in the past, were elite riders just as careful about their food intake as riders today?
No, I think now everybody's very much dialed in. You know, if you look how technology has helped develop the sport, you know, we could tell you the exact amount of carbohydrates our athletes will take before, during, and after races. So I would say, like everything, it's become very scientific, is that there's a lot more understanding about fueling before and on the bike. And there's also a lot more understanding about what you've got to do off the bike as well. So I would say it's changed. It's probably one of the biggest changes in sport, is the amount of information and knowledge there is around food now. You know, just eating what's at a hotel buffet for a professional cyclist doesn't work anymore.
Hmm. And you raced and competed, ran, and you also worked in elite restaurants. Are the pressures to perform similar? I mean, for example, is a vicious critique by a food writer, assuming you ever got a vicious critique, but let's say a food writer you respect or a fellow chef you admire critiqued your meal, a meal you worked on for hours. Is that the same pressure as coming in last in a race?
I think sport in some respects is a lot easier to manage, because sport is defined by success. And to be honest, whoever's got their hands in the air, that's success.
Mm-hmm.
So food is highly subjective. Winning isn't subjective at all. You know, you can tell who won the Tour de France. Mm-hmm. You can tell who won the Olympics. You can tell who won the Mountain Bike World Cup. The performance is measurable, but food is subjective. You know, the best meal in the world can be a home-cooked meal that's prepared with love. You know, it could be a grilled piece of fish on a beach. It could be breakfast in bed. You know, it can be having the family around the table. And I would say that sometimes the best meal in the world could be a very simple pizza cooked, you know, with wood on stone and in Italy. It could be the most simple thing. So I'd say food is a lot more subjective. Elite sport is not subjective. There's winners and there's losers, and there's a finite thing. So I would say that there's a time and a place for fine dining, for extravagance, for exuberance around food. And I think there's also a time for food when you just bring people together and it's the environment and it's the people you're with. So again, with the book, what I've tried to do is just take all the nonsense out and make sure these are healthy meals that people can sit down and eat as a group with your family, with your loved ones, or alternatively to fuel your performance. But so in some respects, elite sports easier than cooking.
You are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, and carried on KBO.fm. And our guest today is Scottish chef, runner, cyclist Alan Murchison, and we're speaking about sports, nutrition, life. His recent book, published by Bloomsbury, is The Cycling Chef, Plant-Powered Performance. And as somebody who tried some of these dishes, I could attest to their quality and yumminess, if that's a word. You write that both cycling and food cultures could be very resistant to change. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at cycling, there's always the, we're always looking backwards, you know what I mean? We always talk about the greats, and there's quite a lot of nostalgia. And if you look at the races that are valued most in professional sport, some of them are hundreds of years old. Like the Tour de France has been around forever. Milan-San Remo, Paris-Roubaix, you know, the monuments, the classics, they're steeped in history. And some of the courses have changed very little in generations. And a lot of the same is with food. There's still classic combinations. Like you could go to restaurants in Italy or France or Spain, and they've been serving dishes that are over 100 years old. So I think there's the evolution, but change and history play a huge part in both food and in cycling. If you think now, you and I could go and eat in a hugely modern restaurant in the middle of Paris, and we could eat coq au vin. We could have, you know, beautiful peach melt, but you could have classical dishes that were reinvented such a long time ago. And it's the same with cycling. You know, you cannot watch a bike race that they don't hark on about Bernardino or Eddie Merckx or the greats of the past. And even the courses, they don't change that much. You know, we still go up all these classic climbs and everything else. So I think they both do like to keep an eye on the past, but also like to move forward. But I say they're both steeped in history, and they're both very much based on tradition.
And in 2000, you've written a couple of books, and this one is for vegans, but also people who are not vegans but want to include more of this kind of food. And in 2019, you suggested that one could not be a plant-based athlete at any level. But over the years, you've modified that position a little bit. What led to your change in perception?
That's a good question. I did actually put that in print in my first book. And I've been asked about it many times. The thing is, at that point, again, in my opinion, it was very hard to do. The plant-based movement, the ability to now buy different protein sources whilst you're traveling, is completely changed. It's a very different kind of platform that you're cooking on nowadays. So if you traveled in you know, 2010 to 2020, and you're looking to buy tofu, tempeh, plant-based milks, plant-based cheeses, etc., it was almost impossible. And certainly even restaurants, like if you'd said to me in the early 2000s that I would be offering a plant-based menu, I'd be laughed at you, because there just wasn't the demand. But I think what's happening is education is increasing. As people are looking at welfare, they're looking at health and well-being, and they're just actually being a little bit more critical of their diet. I think we have changed, and you know, I won't be the last or the first to admit that I've changed my outlook on food now with the plant-based book. I'm not suggesting for one second that everybody needs to stop what they're doing and the dishes that they enjoy. It's just maybe just be a bit more critical. So I'm now maybe plant-based 2-3 days a week. I'll maybe be vegetarian 1 or 2 days a week, and then I'll eat really good quality fish and meat 1 or 2 days a week. My own perspective, it's down to education. It's down to, you know, what we talked about before. I was steeped. I was brought up cooking French cuisine. it was butter and cream and foie gras and truffles and Côte de Bœuf and all those classical French dishes. So I'm changing and I'm learning and I'm evolving as a cook, but also as a sports practitioner. So when we travel with professional sport, quite often it's hard to actually gauge the quality of the protein that you're getting. So if you then eliminate that risk, you know, we can't always go to a local farm. We can't always go to a local butcher or a local fishmonger. So you can actually maintain quality and consistency by including more plant-based dishes. So it's an educational thing, and it's also from me learning and also looking at what athletes and what the general public are wanting. 10 years ago, I don't think that there would have been a demand for a performance book based around plants. I just don't think the market was ready for it.
And as a vegan of 30 years, I could attest that, you know, many years ago it was impossible. If we traveled across America and tried to find a vegan meal or option at a restaurant, it was impossible. And now it's changed so much. I also like that in your book you write that you say, you know, you're not about telling others what to do. Should they eat this? Should they eat that? And it's, your book is not an evangelical rant. You can't solve the world's problem. And you add that obviously you would if you could. I really like that approach. You know, let people, those that are vegan, this is a great book. And those that want to incorporate a few more dishes, it's also a great book. You know, as a vegan, if I had a dollar for every time I heard, so where do you get your protein? I'll be richer than some of these oligarchs that are destroying the world. So what are some good sources of protein for vegans?
Well, you've got pulses and you've got a lot of seeds, which we include, and grains that we include a lot of in there. So what we try and do where possible is that you will see in the book, I've deliberately not used, you know, food replacement. So I've not used like vegan bacon or, you know, I've tried to go away from using fake food because firstly, don't understand the long-term implications of this, and I'm not buying into it. You know, I think if something looks and tastes like meat and it's actually made from artificial ingredients, for the life of me, I can't see how that can be good for you. So you will see there's a lot of pulses that are used in the book. I use chickpeas, I use lentils a lot. There'll be a lot of nuts, there'll be lots of seeds, and there'll be whole grains in there. So I'm aware that it's something that is a hot topic. Again, it's all about having a balance. And what we try and do is we'll incorporate pulses where possible into a lot of the dishes. And again, what I'm trying to do is just say to people is that if this is something you're a little bit vegan curious about, and you want to try it, just do 2 or 3 days a week and see how you get on. I think we're obsessed with protein consumption in the Western world. I've never come across anybody yet that's got a protein deficiency. I've never heard of this. This is something in all the years I've been cooking. We eat so much protein. And if you go to any food store, protein this, protein that, honestly, it's become a trend, you know, that you need X amount of protein. Like, if you're a bodybuilder, if you're doing huge amounts of strength work, potentially, but protein deficiency, honestly, in the Western world, I'm not sure this is even a thing. So I think we're obsessed with protein for no good reason.
And I like another thing I liked about the book was you emphasize the need to get that right balance between carbohydrates, protein, nutrients, vitamins. Our time is flying by like one of the races you help feed the racers over there. So I want to ask you a little bit about your own sporting activities and accomplishments. You are a champion in, can you describe a little bit your own competitive?
I used to run when I was younger. I was a fairly decent runner, and I ran for Scotland. So I used to run like 29 minutes for 10K, but that was before carbon shoes. So that's got a little asterisk before. And then when I was, I got out of sport with work, just consumed me for many years, and I got back into sport in my late 30s. So in my 40s, I competed in duathlon and did quite well. I won my age group at world championships a couple of times.
And that involves running and then cycling and then running again? Or?
But my main passion was always time trialing. I'm an avid time trialer. So I've ridden in my 40s, I rode 18 minutes for 10 miles. So I'm an okay time trialer. So I love time trialing. I love the science. I love the aerodynamics. But now I'm more into mountain bike and gravel. So I've kind of gone over to that side of it. So I spend a lot of time in the woods and the trails, just riding my bike and just learning new skills. But I'm a lifelong cyclist. I, you know, when I was young, I used to deliver newspapers to buy BMX parts. Hmm. You know, this is what I did as a kid growing up. So I've always been into bikes, and but now I try and race mountain bike when I can.
And mentioning time trials made me think of the importance of timing in the kitchen also. So, you know,
There's a science side to both of those things. You know, there's a science to going fast and there's a science to cooking well. Mm. I got much more excited about the science of going fast on a bike than I did about the science of cooking, because I believe cooking is more of an art, art form. The science side of it is something that I found less interesting. But with cycling, I understand the importance of science and metrics, for sure.
And there's so many more questions I want to ask you, but we only have a couple of minutes. What is next for you? Where might we find you in 5-10 years?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'm currently the team chef for Specialized Factory Racing. So I work for the best mountain bike team in the world, and we travel all over the place, going to cool places, winning mountain bike races. So I have 7 athletes I work with at the moment, and I enjoy that a lot. You know, I hope to continue working with Specialized up until LA Olympics in 28. So it would be kind of cool to go there with an American team, an American brand, and hopefully do something pretty cool at LA Olympics. So I would say that's the kind of medium term. I live in Girona, Spain, which is obviously a big cycling hub. And I just want to continue to evolve, you know, as a sports practitioner. It's just learn more. And I want to continue working in elite sport. I like working in elite sport. I like the mentality of it. I like the fact there's no compromise and that you need a team of people to deliver excellence. So for me, all of these things are really important, and I enjoy that work environment. So whatever happens in the next 5 to 10 years, I'll still be chasing excellence in one form or another.
And you don't want to go back to having a restaurant or...
No, honestly, there's no money in the world that would get me. I did that for over 25 years, and I've done.
You paid your dues.
I've done my time, and I think it's a bit like, you know, when you get these world-class sportsmen, the key is knowing when to stop. And I know when to stop with restaurants. You could not get me to go back into a restaurant working ever again. I've done it. Nothing left to prove. Don't need to do it. So, retired.
Well, we'll retire from this conversation, even though I still have so many questions. Thank you, Alan Murtazed, for speaking with us today from Spain, and all the best with whatever adventure is next for you. I have a strong feeling that there are many more coming your way as you create them. And if you ever make it to Portland, Oregon, please don't be a stranger. We'll be happy to host you, and I'll prepare one of your dishes. So
I look forward to that.
Okay, all the best. Thank you so much.
Cheers, thank you.
We have been speaking with a chef, cyclist, runner, and author of several cookbooks, including The Cyclic Chef, Plant-Powered Performance, Vegan Recipes to Fuel Your Ride. All these books are from Bloomsbury. And you're listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, the first Wednesday of the month. And we're in the middle of raising funds for our station. There have been cuts to the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. It's been eliminated pretty much. So please, if you're able to, please contribute to KBOO. Any amount counts and is appreciated. We've been speaking with Alan Murchison, and we'll take a short break. When we return, co-host Nedra Deadweiler will be speaking with Pacha Gatavis of Minneapolis. And stay tuned, please.
Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, co-host, Nedra Deadweiler, and we were just listening to Alon speak with Alan Merchantson and his guest, cyclist, author, and athlete extraordinaire. Now, for the second half, we will turn to and welcome on to the show, Pasha Gavalis, the founder of BC Chica. She is also an artist based in Minnesota. BC Chicas is a cycling collective that is led by and centers Black, Brown, and Indigenous women and STEM presenting people. The organization offers resources and support for communities of color to feel empowered on a bike. Hello, Pasha. Welcome onto KBOO Bike Radio. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so good to have you here. You know, just I've seen you on social media in the past, and it's, you know, it's really great to see, you know, women, femme folk out there doing things by bike, women of color doing things by bike, and just, you know, it's really encouraging. I'm so glad that you had the time, and I'd love to hear more about who you are, you know, your art, the work that you do with your collective, and could you start by just sharing more about who you are, Pasha, and with our audience, just to know like more about you, and who are you?
I'm Pacha, that's my nickname, that's what I go by at home with family, and decided to use that as my artist name at one point, and so that's what people know me by. I started off, you know, I grew up in Minneapolis for the most part, but I am from Mexico, my family's from Mexico, so I'm Chicana, and have lived in Mexico a little bit as a baby, as a toddler, but mostly grew up here, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I guess I'm a cyclist here. I care a lot about community and accessibility to biking here in the city. There's a very, very big bike culture here. So it's one of like the main bike cities in the U.S. I don't know what it ranks right now, but it used to be like number one or number two. And so we have a lot of bike trails, there's a lot of lakes and parks, and it's just very green here. So it's nice when it's warm out. People do bike in the winter. I don't so much, but yeah, I got into biking when I was around 10, and then really it was our main form of transportation, and we would go everywhere on the bike. We'd go fishing, we'd go to the park, we'd go do our grocery shopping and whatnot. And then as I got older, I got back into biking because, you know, got into driving because I was a teenager, young adult, not wanting to be on a bike anymore. And as a young adult, I got back into biking. And so that's when I started BC Chicas. Is later on, you know, when I started to notice that driving a car was a hassle. It was expensive. It would make me angry, moody. And being on a bike would do the opposite. It would make me relaxed. It would make me feel better. And I got to see more of nature. Yeah. So that's a little bit about me.
Yeah. I mean, that's some really good stuff right there. And one, just like that biculturalness, being able to have that come into the name, BC Chicas. Could you tell more, more about the name and how did you settle upon BC Chicas? Because it's not easy naming anything, especially something that has a big meaning, like, you know, all of the work that you're doing.
Yeah. So it's actually kind of funny. I came up with this name, BC Chicas. The original spelling was like C-H-I-C-A-S for Chicas, like the normal way you would spell it. And it was just kind of a placeholder, actually, because I'm like, I don't know what to call this. But I knew I wanted to do something where, like, whether it was hosting bike rides or bike mechanic classes, I wanted it to sound femme and to be, like, inviting and welcoming to women, femmes, or femme-presenting people. So I was just kind of using that as, like, a, you know, it's very kind of, it's like the bike chicks or something, you know, it's, like, very basic, but then I kept it, and I changed the spelling because I started to think more about it. You know, I was kind of learning about my own culture and Chicanismo and Mexican culture, and so in those kind of like readings that I was having, because for a moment I was part of the Brown Berets and they were very big on talking about like Chicanismo, right? And and so I started to think about it, and I'm like, really, the word chica or chico comes from Chicano or Chicana, which comes from the word Mexicano, Mexicana, you know, being like being from Mexico or Mexican. And the word Mexican or Mexicano, Mexicana, comes from the word Mexica, which is like what people call Aztecs. You know, Aztec is kind of the colonizer word for Mexica culture, Mexica tribe. And that's where the name, you know, that's where the imagery of the Mexican flag, like the eagle perched on the cactus eating a snake. It's like from a, you know, this story of how people actually came from North America and you know, were kind of nomadic or left their tribe to find a new home, and the symbolism, or basically were told by a god that it, once they found an eagle perched on a cactus eating a snake, that would be their place of home. And so anyway, I won't get too far into that because there's not great things about that story either. Basically, they kicked out the original people of what is now known as Mexico City. It used to be a lake there, and it was very beautiful. But anyway, that's where Mexican, the word Mexico comes from. So anyway, I was trying to, you know, like pay, you know, respect to that, you know, to like chica, chico really should be spelled with an X. So I hope that made sense. Mm-hmm. But if it's, you know, if it's the word Mexica and we're talking about Mexico, it really should be Mexico, you know, and Chicana and Chicano come from that. So I just thought I'd change it to an X. It has nothing to do with gender because a lot of people think of like Latin X, like where the X is at the end, and it kind of, you know, it is more to be neutral, like gender neutral. But this has nothing to do with that. This is just more talking about the word Mexica and how we identify with that culture, even though a lot of us are not Mexica. I don't think I really am Mexica, but I don't associate with a tribe. You know, I didn't grow up with a tribe, so I don't know what tribe like my family came from in the past. But you know, overall, we call ourselves Mexican, kind of like people calling themselves American. It's a very general term, I guess.
Yeah,
so that's a little bit about the name.
That deep, Yeah, no, the deep dive into Mexican history and culture and imagery is very important, and yeah. especially how it overlaps with, cultural work here, political activism, you know, and it's all interchanged, because we know that riding a bike is, it can be seen as a, some people see it as a political act, because you're on a bike and not in the car, you make it a choice. It's a very yeah. big statement. Yeah. And bringing in culture as an anchor and the meaning of it, seems very important to you. I know it's important to a lot of people, just culture that they're yeah. raised in and that they're derived from. And you say a lot, your members or people who are part of the collective are not necessarily Mexicanas, or necessarily identify as Chicana, but who can you tell us more about who is a part of, who see themselves in the collective, and maybe, you know, how there is a bridge?
Yeah, so most of the members, you know, there's not really a set, like, crew, there's just people that come and go, you know, so there really is like a small crew that has been around since the beginning, and one of those people is Carmen. There's, you know, friends of mine that have always supported me, family, community, and then there's people that just come once or twice and just know that they can always come back, you know. So I consider everyone mm-hmm. that comes through the door like part of the collective. Like if you're coming in even just to get a bike repair, or you came to one of the rides, like you're part of the crew in my mind. If I see you on the street, you know, I'm going to say hi, I'm going to remember you. And people do remember each other. People have become friends from just coming to the bike rides and things like that. So the idea is to build community and to be, so, you know, a lot of us are biking alone, and don't have other people to bike with. And so the idea is that, you know, you don't have to be part of EC Chica's events all the time, but if you meet someone at my event and you can ride with them later on, like that's all I want. You know, I want people to have biking buddies and feel part of something. But yeah, there's a lot of different ethnicities. Like we have Black women and East African and Asian, you know, East Asian or South Asian. So Southeast Asian folks coming in. We have a big like Somali community, Hmong community, a big Native and Black community in Minneapolis, and so we see people from all over the world, basically. mm-hmm. And then a lot of, you know, a lot of us are, right now I'm connecting with the Latino families in Southside, so I mostly stay in Southside. I would like to expand more into Northside and other parts of the city, but Vista Chica really is, like, centered in South Minneapolis. But yeah, in Southside right now, there's some dual, like Spanish dual language schools. There's a lot of, mm-hmm. it's not just Latino folks, but they do speak Spanish and English as in their school as a whole. And so I'm working with a lot of the Latino families there and the moms especially. And so right now that's more of a focus this year, and working with, Migizi, one of the, it's like Native-led or Native schools here in Minneapolis. It's for the youth mostly. There's a Green Tech program run by NVIDIA. Mm-hmm. And that was the most recent workshop that I did. I did a week class, you know, a week-long class for the high school students to get introduced into. There's a basically a bike mechanic course offered at one of the community colleges here at, it's called Minneapolis College here in Minneapolis. And so mm-hmm. the kids were able to come in, do a quick 4-day course and be introduced to this classroom and all the resources here. And hopefully they come back. But yeah, I would love to keep, you know, keep working with these people at the, you know, there's people that work with the kids at the schools regularly there. I would love to keep connecting with these folks as, you know, and take their input as part of EC Chicas. How can we make things better? How can we be more inclusive and meet the needs of our community members, right? That's the goal. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to tell people what they need. I want to know what they need so I, you know, we can cater to that community need, if that makes sense. So, yeah, there's different
different things going on all over the city. You can want to just ride a bike, you know, for fun. Some people, you know, need it for transportation. Some people want to learn bike mechanics to kind of, you know, learn the mechanical side. There's just all sorts of like wants and needs out here.
Yeah. Well, doing the great work. I'm going to do a station announcement and then I'll come back with our next question. So you are listening to KBOO Bike Radio, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBOO FM. And all shows are archived on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. Pasha, so you just shared, like, I think it's interesting, like, your early life where you use biking for transportation fun all over the place, doing everything. And now you're doing the same thing now in your adult life, everything on the bike, mechanic, and you're teaching others to demystify, like, what it means to be on a bike. You learn how to work it, how to prepare it, but then also talking with children, working with children, and educating them. With these collaborations, what has made those collaborations very fruitful for you?
What was the question? What made the collaborations meaningful?
Like, yeah, meaningful.
Oh, okay.
and to allow it to flourish, because it can be difficult working with the school system, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, really, what, you know, gives me gratification is seeing someone feel empowered. So whether it's like biking somewhere new, or doing something new on the bike while you're biking, whether it's like practicing street skills or, you know, getting around, reading a map, or just like learning how to use a tool, changing your flat tire, something like that. It's simple little things that make people feel, you know, empowered, and their confidence goes up. And so when I see that, I mean, that's my goal, really. It's, I'll teach a class, but it's, you know, you don't have to learn everything 100%. I just want people to try it. I want people to kind of feel that they have the power to fix their own bike or get around on their own. It's really about autonomy and, you know, building that confidence, especially for kids. I think it's so important because if we want to, you know, I think just biking in general touches on so many issues like racial justice, environmental justice, economic justice. And really, like, I feel that we need to really focus on the kids, even though, you know, I work with mostly adults, but I just think that they're the next generation that's going to, you know, either take this and, I guess, like, I just feel like we're setting them up for, you know, success. And so if they can have this as an option, you know, maybe you don't want to bike all the time, but you know that it's there, that it's, you know where to go if you need a bike or who to talk to support you, you know. So I just want, you know, the schools and all these community partners that I work with to be that resource. And really that's my goal, is just to spread knowledge, like share skills, and not be the one person that has all, you know, is like gatekeeping the knowledge and skills. I want everyone to know it so that everyone can share it with each other. And even little kids are very smart and teach each other. I watch 10-year-olds like do all the basic bike repairs that I taught them, and they were even able to like go on stage and present what they learned. And I was like, oh my God, look, they're teaching their parents. Their parents didn't even know how to do this, and now they're teaching their own family, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty empowering. So
it's pretty cool.
It's really cool, and it's also exciting. I can see how that is meaningful for you. How did you gain the bike mechanic skills? What was your process? What was your learning journey to doing all of the work that you're doing right now?
Yeah, I would watch every time I took my bike in to get it fixed. I'd go to these community shops. There were more of them back in the day, like 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just ask the mechanics. You know, I'd be like, oh, I have a flat tire. And I'd ask the mechanic, like, can I watch you? And they'd be like, yeah, sure. You know, most bike mechanics are cool like that. They'll show you what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, explain. And so I just appreciated that most people would, like, let me watch and learn. And then I started to think, you know what? I think I could do this. Like, I don't have to pay someone every time I get a flat. So it's just watching made me a little bit more confident in trying it. But then I did work at a community bike shop called Cycles for Change, which also shut down recently. And I worked in the, you know, even though I wasn't a bike mechanic because I didn't know how to do repairs, I was helping run a bike grant program and a learn to ride, you know, teaching adults how to ride a bike. But there was an open shop where basically they had stations where you could come in. I think it was every other day. You could come in and use their station with the tools, and it was free. And then if you wanted help, there was a mechanic that would go around and help you. So I would sit in the back there, even though it wasn't my department, and I would just, like, work on my own bike, try to help people. And there was, like, these youths. It was a group of young folks, like, in high school that were working the open shops usually. So they taught me a lot. I actually learned from, like, high schoolers. And one of the main mechanics, his name was Jacob. He was very helpful, and he was very patient. And so I basically just asked questions and was just nosy and in the back area, just being like, I want to learn this too. I felt like that was a great opportunity since everything was there. And, you know, we did mostly recycling. So I learned kind of like the kind of refurbishing, recycling, grungy way. Now I'm working at a more established bike center and thing, you know, I'm putting on new parts and working on higher end bikes, and I'm like, wow, this is a whole other world. I'm very used to, like, Frankensteining bikes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's how I learned, just with a lot of used parts, recycled parts at a DIY bike space.
Yeah, that's very cool. And it sounds like what you're telling us is that the network that you're in, the ecosystem, is starting to, is changing. Mm-hmm. Who are your other collaborators, or, like, what is the network looking like right now? And is the mission of BC Chica still the same, or have that caused you to expand, contract? Yeah, how does that impact you?
That's a good question. I think about this all the time and talk about it with folks. So, yeah, I mean, you've heard me say, like, a couple times, things shut down, and it's really something that is really unfortunate, because a lot of these community bike shops or places that we're used to going aren't there, and, you know, it's something to do with, you know, capitalism or whatnot, but we're losing some of our main spots. You know, like, the Hub Co-op was one of the spots that supported me with wholesale bike parts, and I could go in there and look through their used bins, and they're right down the street from where I have my bike shop, and so I'd get a lot of stuff from them. And then they shut down recently, and everyone was just like, what's going on? You know, all the people in the community are asking me, like, where'd they go, what happened? I'm like, I don't know. And right now, like, we do have some, we still have places like Soul Cycle on Chicago Avenue. Venture Bikes is on the Greenway. We have a bike trail called the Greenway here by Lake Street, and they're a big resource in the community. You know, they're a community bike shop. They're helping, you know, doing the same type of work. And so even though we have we've lost some bike shops, we still have some, and I think just, you know, supporting those, like, telling people to go there to get their bike fixed, to buy a bike if I'm not around. You know, I do the basic bike repairs, and I'm not there all the time. It's not a bike shop like a storefront. You know, you set up an appointment with me, and if you want to take a class, we set up a time. And so it's just a little bit more low-key, and most of the time I'm telling people to go to these other community bike shops. So at least those are there, and I hope that they stay there. Has changed a little bit. I think before I was more focused on bike rides and just getting people together. I got a little bit scared after the pandemic and after the uprising here in Minneapolis things just got a little bit weird on the streets. Like, I don't feel like they're as safe or that people are following the rules of the road when they're driving as much. I've just seen a change in the way people drive. We've also experienced, like, more gentrification, like more people coming into Minneapolis, living here, you know, from out of state. And so it's getting a little bit more congested. I just, sometimes I just worry about, like, can I keep everyone safe while on the road? So I've been, like, holding off on bike rides just because I want to, I'd rather support other bike rides that are happening and direct people to those. And so more focus on the education side and working with the schools and teaching classes. And then right now, just the bike rides that I'm planning are just with the schools, with the elementary school and middle school and high school here in Southside, with the moms and the parents. So it feels a little bit more safe to do it that way when it's just like a bunch of parents and their kids, rather than me leading a ride on my own with bike marshals and BC Chica staff. It's changed a little, but I hope to get back, to get that confidence back, with the right, like, you know, crew, we can still lead bike rides. I think it's just taking me a while to get back out there like that.
Yeah, well, that's understandable. But, and it also sounds like the work that you're doing with the schools and the families and the community is really important. So I hope you can, you know, expand and do all the things that you want to do. I appreciate you bringing up, you know, bike shops as hubs, you know, like centers for of convening people. I'm wondering, because you're an artist, could you, you know, we kind of got in on last minute. Can you tell us about your art, and just does it come into your bike life at all? Is there a connection there?
Yeah, I'm actually working on that. I've always separated the two and have in the past, like, focused more on the art side and was interested in doing murals, like community murals, or just painting. I really like doing, like, live art, you know, painting or drawing at an event with music, or, you know, at a festival or something like that, where people can see you doing art, you know, in the moment. And so I was doing a lot of that, like portraits. I would do quick portraits or, you know, a painting for an event. And then during the pandemic, it kind of stopped. And then I didn't get back into it the same afterwards. I kind of got more into biking and trying to push BC Chicas forward. And so now I'm like, let's bring the world, you know, the two worlds together. Why can't it be both? I really like there's a group called Alebrijes in biking, or Bike Alebrijes. I forget their name on Facebook, but basically they're a group that creates these big puppets and they put them on the back of bikes and they display them like at parades or at events for Dia de los Muertos. And so I really like that group because they're creating these big, beautiful puppets, and then they're also biking with them. I'm like, wow, they figured it out. They're doing both. And so I like joining groups like that, and I hope to do more events where we're creating art, or we're, you know, inviting artists, and we're also, like, encouraging people to bike. Maybe we bike there, maybe we bike afterwards, or... you know, so lately what we do is throw little parties at our bike shop. And that's like my attempt to mix the art world with the biking world. So, yeah, I hope there's more of that in the upcoming years.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great. Good luck with that, and hope that that comes true and that you bring more of your art into your work. How can people find you, Pasha, and bike... And BC Chicas?
Yes. Well, we're on Facebook and Instagram. Really, those are the two main ways you can find us. I'm working on a website. But yeah, right now, you can find us on, it's BC Chicas, BICI space, and then XICAS on Facebook or Instagram. We do have a GoFundMe right now, since we're trying to raise funds to get, you know, more professional development happening, like, you know, that includes the website, or, you know, becoming possibly a nonprofit. We were an LLC, and so we're just thinking of a better way to get consistent funding and buy some equipment and things like that. So yeah, check us out. I don't post as much right now. I'm trying to post more to keep people updated on what we're doing. So yeah, look for those Instagram posts. And then if you're in the area, you're welcome to come to any of our events or bike rides, classes. So yeah, if you ever have a bike question, you can email me.
Oh, will do. Thank you so much, Pasha, for joining us on the show today. And we will hope to see you again. Definitely see you on in the digital space.
Yes. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I had a lot of fun.
Okay, great.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7.